Ben Weisner. I'm an attorney with the ACLU. I'm actually speaking from Guantanamo's Camp Justice, which is a tent city that was constructed for military commission trials here. I'm speaking to Jonathan Mahler, who is the author of The Challenge, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, a terrific book about the Hamdan case. And as it happens, I'm here in Guantanamo for the Hamdan trial. So, Jonathan, why don't we really start from the beginning?
Sure.
How did you get involved in writing about Salem Hamdan?
Well, it started actually with I am a writer for the New York Times Magazine, and in the spring of 2004, I wrote a profile of Hamdan's first military lawyer, who's actually now, as you know, Ben, continuing to represent him as a civilian. He's since left the military. Lieutenant Commander Charlie Swift was his handle when I profiled him back in 2004. And at the time, he'd been just sort of recently appointed by the Pentagon to defend Hamdan, and had only met him a couple times at that point, and had just actually filed a lawsuit on his behalf in federal court with the help of a law professor at Georgetown, Neil Katyal. And I was fascinated by the story, and I was initially kind of most interested in the relationship between Swift and Hamdan and the notion of this Navy JAG lawyer, graduate of the Naval Academy, kind of building a relationship with and sort of earning the trust of a suspected terrorist and how that was going to go, particularly because Swift, Swift is an incredibly zealous lawyer, incredibly zealous defense lawyer, and really a passionate defense lawyer, so it just seemed like it was going to be kind of an interesting story. I didn't think at the time that the lawsuit was going to really go anywhere, because at that point, the Bush administration had decided that Guantanamo was sort of out of the jurisdiction of the federal courts, and all of the courts who'd been asked to rule on this question had agreed. Of course, lo and behold, a few months after my story came out, or even really just a month after my story came out, the Rasool decision came down, which made it clear that, in fact, the Guantanamo was within the jurisdiction of the U.S. courts, which enabled their lawsuit, which sort of challenged the lawfulness of these military tribunals, to get some traction, and up it went through the federal court system, and over the course of several years, they won at the district court level in the sort of dramatic ruling, which was handed down during the pretrial proceedings of the military commission.
In fact, one of my colleagues was here.
I was there too.
During the proceedings, and you were too.
I was there too. It was incredibly dramatic. We were all in the courtroom. It was a pretty small group, actually. We were all in the courtroom, and the Swift had just gotten up and given his first argument. It had taken about 45 minutes, and an MP walked in and handed the military judge a little post-it note. He adjourned the court for about 15 minutes. No one knew what was going on, and then he came back in and said that we were in indefinite recess, and it was because the federal judge had just handed down an opinion saying basically that these trials were illegal and that they had to stop immediately.
This ended up being really a book about the lawsuit and the lawyers, and I think I know the answer to this question, but I want people to know this. In all your years writing about Hamdan and his case, have you ever had a chance to sit down and interview Hamdan?
I have not, because the government does not allow that. Like you, I've glimpsed him in the courtroom on Guantanamo, and that's it. However, I did in 2005 go to Yemen to meet his family, and I did that, and I got to spend several days with them, and also with, as it turned out, with the guy who had initially recruited him for jihad, who I believe there's actually a videotape of him that you may be seeing at some point during the course of this trial, Ben.
Right. Well, you've had incredible access, it seems, to Charlie Swift and to Neil Katyal, and in a way, The Challenge really is a story of those two lawyers, their missions, their ambitions, their quirks, I would say some of their character weaknesses, and certainly their overwhelming strengths. And tell us how you were able to spend that amount of time with those two men.
Yeah, well, what happened really was after my story came out in 2004, I got along very well with Charlie Swift while I was writing the piece, and so I said, look, I'm gonna write this book. what do you think? And he said, sure, great. So, you know, over the course of years, as the case kind of moved along and the story moved along, I was just kind of constantly talking to him, constantly going down to Washington, actually staying in his house and spending days at a time with him. And Neil Katyal also was very cooperative with me, though he was a little more circumspect during the course of the case. But after the Supreme Court argument and decision came down, he too was enormously cooperative with me, and you know, shared his personal diaries with me, and really kind of spent hundreds of hours kind of retracing this whole journey. So I guess in Swift's case, I kind of followed it in real time, and in Katyal's case, he kind of downloaded it on me a little bit later. But yeah, it was I have to say, I mean, this is sort of what I do for a living, is try to get people to cooperate with me, and I've never had this kind of degree of cooperation from two characters, so that was great.
It's quite an intriguing partnership, and you can say more about this. I think that you would say that there are no two lawyers who are more different than these two.
Yeah.
But I think that the story of this case is a testament to how each one of them was absolutely critically necessary to what happened.
And totally.
I've been coming down here for several years as well to observe these military commission proceedings. And what's really clear is that the Pentagon made a catastrophic political error when they decided to have these detainees represented by military men in uniform. I think that they expected to have more control.
That's right.
They were doing was legitimizing their critics in a way that never would have been possible if it was ACLU lawyers standing.
That's exactly right.
System. When you had and at the same time, Charlie Swift, bless his soul, was not going to take that case to the Supreme Court on his own.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, to the first point, I mean, even the first prosecutor, who's long gone, Scott Lang, you may remember him from the early days, he told me that, and he and Swift actually do not get along at all. I mean, he's a real government prosecutor, and he told me that back in the very beginning of the process, the Pentagon was absolutely convinced that that all these defense JAG lawyers were just going to kind of roll. I mean, these were the sort of the suits in the Pentagon were all convinced that these JAG defense lawyers were going to just roll over and get their guys to offer guilty pleas. And Scott Lang, that first prosecutor, said, no, you guys are wrong. They're not going to do that. And that's exactly what happened. And as you say, it was a huge political mistake. I mean, these guys, not only people like Swift and their others too, didn't only sort of vigorously defend their clients and insist that they were innocent. They in fact challenged the whole system. But as you say, Charlie is, you know, he is really a trial lawyer in the kind of classic sense. He's a great raconteur and you know, really the kind of guy who builds sort of a great kind of counter narrative of his client's innocence. Gets very close to his clients, really gets to know them, and just sort of immerses himself in their story. And he's a very kind of intuitive, emotional person. But he is not by any stretch a legal scholar, and he did not have the grasp of constitutional law and the ability to write briefs and make arguments in more formal settings, to, you know, to appellate judges and ultimately to the Supreme Court that Katyal did. And so Katyal was really the person who was really the kind of intellectual architect of the lawsuit, while Swift was kind of keeping Hamdan alive on Guantanamo and fighting for all of his rights inside Camp Delta. Katyal was kind of building the lawsuit, and so that was the pairing. And just in terms of personality, I mean, Charlie is a really kind of garrulous and great big kind of bear of a guy who just kind of lays it all out on the table. It's just an open book. And Neil Katyal is a very, very cautious, you know, brilliant and ambitious, but very, you know, very, very sort of calculating and much more reserved kind of person. So they really are, you know, quite an odd couple.
Well, and the book actually does a really fine job of showing us what the consequences of this case have been on the lives of these two men. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Neil, although he was already a rising star in our profession, was catapulted into the stratosphere by winning the Hamdan case in the Supreme Court. And Charlie, while he certainly became almost a household name for a time, in part because of the profiles like yours and many others, has paid a different kind of cost, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Neil certainly, I mean, it was his very first, it was certainly his first argument at the Supreme Court, but it was in fact one of his first arguments in any courtroom anywhere. I mean, he argued in law school. He had a clinic that landlord-tenant dispute. He argued a traffic ticket in high school, and while he was working at the Justice Department at some point in his 20s, he argued one case in appellate court, I think. And aside from that, this was it. That was it. So, you know, then he went to the Supreme Court, argued what is you know, arguably the most important case on presidential power ever, and won it. So, yeah, for him, it was obviously quite a boon. But for Charlie, it was it ultimately cost his marriage. Really, I mean, his wife left him right in the aftermath of the Supreme Court argument, and because partly because he was so absorbed in this case for so many years that they really kind of grew apart, because he was constantly going down to Guantanamo. He was constantly talking to reporters like me, kind of keeping us abreast of everything that was going on, because he certainly saw the media as an important part of their defense. And it also cost him his military career, quite possibly. We don't know for sure, because the military doesn't tell you, but Swift was not promoted, and he was up for promotion right in the midst of the Supreme Court case. So, so one could certainly make the case that, had he might have been promoted had he not kind of put up such a vigorous opposition to the government.
And the case has been both a triumph and a tragedy for Hamdan himself.
Hamdan too, yeah. I mean, it's sort of an amazing, that's what's kind of so amazing about this whole story is, you have these two lawyers who win this just enormous and improbable victory. And, to some extent, Hamdan couldn't help but get kind of caught up in this and in some of the excitement about it. But, it certainly hasn't changed his fate any. And, of course, now that these, as you know better than anyone, is now that these trials are finally going forward, in the event that he's acquitted, which he probably won't be, but let's say he is, government could hang on to him anyway. So for him, his name is now in legal textbooks across America, but he's still on Guantanamo Bay and will be certainly for the foreseeable future. So
that's exactly right. In fact, I was in a hearing in his case, not this week, but some months ago, where Hamdan and the judge were actually discussing the Supreme Court case.
That's right.
Hamdan said, "I have been with Swift now for over 4 years." He said, "I think I know the law better than he does," and all the lawyers in the gallery laughed at that.
Right, that's
but
good.
He said, what has it gotten me? He said, I went to the Supreme Court and I won.
Right.
And they went to the Congress. Did the Congress change the law just to prosecute me?
Right.
I'm still here. I'm
right.
Still in isolation.
Yeah.
And why should I go through with this exercise of a trial?
Yeah.
In the end, he decided that he would go through with this exercise, and,
right.
And he is represented by extremely able lawyers.
And he's been in court. He's shown up in court every day. He hasn't missed a day.
He has left once or twice for reasons that were unrelated to anything like a boycott, but he has been showing up. And I have to say, the trial has been extraordinary. Each and every government witness, a parade of criminal investigators from the FBI and the military, have talked about their dozens of interrogations with Hamdan
really?
Over and over again. They described him as polite, cooperative, amiable.
Yep.
He provided useful intelligence to them.
Yep.
They all agree was not involved in the planning or execution of any terrorist attack,
yeah.
Let alone 9/11.
But and these are the government witnesses.
These are the government witnesses who
yeah.
used all of his cooperation to then turn around and hang him.
No, I know. I
was the first person to be prosecuted because he was the first person to speak.
Yeah.
And he continued to speak.
Yeah.
And that's what's so perverse about this whole
yeah.
exercise. And the other thing is that he is being linked to those terrorist attacks that even
that's
the government
true.
Says he was not involved in. We've seen footage of this trial with
that's right.
running into buildings and charred bodies and
that's right. I mean,
Arabs firing
yeah.
guns.
That's one of the things I sort of write about in the book is this when I write about why Hamdan, why they chose Hamdan, I sort of make the point that one of the reasons was certainly that because he was working for bin Laden not just at the time of 9/11 but during the embassy bombings in East Africa and the coal bombing, that the government could would certainly turn his trial into sort of a history of Al-Qaeda's jihad against America, whether or not he was directly involved in it or not. So narratively he was appealing. And then I was just going to make one other point in response to your comment, which is dead on about him cooperating, that one of the people I interviewed for the book, who I think you've seen testify down there, Ali Soufan, who was sort of the FBI's foremost expert on Al-Qaeda, told me that, and he was Hamdan's really main FBI interrogator, was encouraging the government to use him as a witness against sort of bigger fish, that he was a great witness, that he had seen, you know, as bin Laden's driver, he had seen so many people, he had seen who bin Laden was with at every step, and he was incredibly cooperative, and he was shocked when the government decided to actually try Hamdan.
Well, this man from Yemen with a fourth grade education, as you said, already had his name in the law books.
Yeah.
On perhaps the most significant presidential power decision ever, or at least in the last half century.
Yeah.
He is now also going to have his name in the history books as the first person the United States has prosecuted since Tokyo and Nuremberg.
Yep, that's right.
And perhaps there will be another book in this on the Hamdan trials as well.
I know, it really is remarkable.
I do encourage everyone to read the book. The book, again, is called The Challenge. I've been speaking to Jonathan Mahler, and I think the book goes on sale the first week of August, but it can already be ordered now. Thanks for sharing with us, Jonathan.
Please, thank you.